The Sunstone Foundation presents Non-Hierarchical Revelation. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
But that wasn't too bad. I'd like to call this session to order. I'll first introduce Dr. Todd Compton, a PhD with a he has a PhD in classics from UCLA. The subject he focused on was the poet a scapegoat in Greek myth. He's a returned missionary from Ireland. One of his hobbies is music, which he plays, popular and classical. And he says his one claim to fame is that he published an article on Paul McCartney in Popular Culture. Our respondent is Catherine H. Schertz. She has a Master of Education, an EDM from Harvard Graduate School, as well as an MTS from Harvard Divinity School. She now resides in Salt Lake, where she uses those 2 degrees to raise 3 boys and 3 girls. She's a past member of the Board of Editors of Dialogue, and her degrees were an emphasis in American church history. Now I'll turn the time first to Dr. Compton.
This talk is an example of the principle that if you go all the way toward the right, you end up on the left. In other words, I don't think that Iron Rod Mormons would typically emphasize this subject, revelation, moving from someone lower in a hierarchy up to someone higher. Rather, it sounds like a quintessential Sunstone talk. Yet, I first began to seriously notice this pattern as I taught a Sunday school class for 2 years, and as I was trying to read the New Testament and Book of Mormon carefully. I admit that my subversive Sunstone training may have conditioned me to see patterns that conservative Mormons don't see, but I have not created these patterns out of thin air. They are in the scriptures and in church history. Before I begin, I should mention a little bit about my complex attitude toward church leaders. I think they can be inspired, but are still human and fallible. We find this principle all through the scriptures and church history. Moses did not enter the promised land because he disobeyed God at Meribath Kadesh. According to Paul, as we will see, Peter acted hypocritically in response to social pressure. Lehi joined Laman and Lemuel in murmuring against the Lord. Jonah did not want to save the repentant city of Nineveh, and so on. Some might think that an emphasis on this idea is overly critical of prophets and church leaders, even anti-Mormon. I entirely disagree. Emphasizing the fallibility of inspired leaders is the only defense against simplistic anti-Mormon critics. Otherwise, we have to run around in a state of paranoia, covering up well-documented failings of church leaders in an unconvincing and seemingly dishonest way. And thus, as we try to cover up past mistakes, we add a whole new layer of failings to church history for the next generation of leaders to be paranoid about. Okay, I should also make one other preliminary clarification. While some might make a strong distinction between revelation and inspiration, in this paper I will treat them as if they are closely related, different in strength but on the same continuum, and will consider inspiration, including moral insight, to be a sort of revelation. With these preliminaries out of the way, I'll begin. The first test case is the confrontation of Paul and Peter at Antioch, which Paul describes in Galatians 2. It would be nice to have Peter's version of this event, but for the time being, in true fundamentalist fashion, let's take Paul at face value and say his version, not the lost Petrine version, is substantially true. Okay, quote from the Bible. When Peter came to Antioch, I, this is Paul writing, opposed him to his face because he was in the wrong. Before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles because he was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. The other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy. so that by their hypocrisy even Barnabas was led astray. When I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter in front of them all, You are a Jew, yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How is it then that you force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? End of quote. Let's reconstruct the background of this incident. Peter is something equivalent to the president of the primitive church, the leading member of the 12 original apostles selected by Christ. Earlier, Peter had received an important vision relaxing the dietary laws of the Old Testament and encouraging Gentiles to become Christian. Paul was an apostle who had received a personal visitation from Christ, but was not one of the 12. So in our terms, we have a president of the church on the one hand, and a junior apostle, not even a member of the quorum of the 12, on the other. Peter, in line with his revelation and Paul's perspective, eats with Gentile Christians, a highly symbolic act of Christian unity, as generally Jews were revolted by the idea of eating in common with Gentiles, and probably a ritual act connected with the early celebration of the sacrament. But as he eats, some visitors from James, leader of a conservative faction of the primitive church, which was concerned with preserving Jewish ritual purity in Christianity, arrive. Peter immediately withdraws from table fellowship. Barnabas and other Christians follow him. To Paul, this is an act of moral cowardice, and he denounces Peter publicly, quote, to his face, quote, in front of them all. He, quote, he was in the wrong. He was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. He's not mincing his words here. He, along with others, played the hypocrite, and the Greek word is nice. You can see that hypocrite root there, sun ep kritheson. They carried Barnabas away with their hypocrisy. Hypocrite word again, te hypocrisy. They were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel. I think the hypocrisy language is very strong, especially since hypocrisy was the central accusation Christ leveled against the Pharisees. Thus, when Peter had abdicated his position of moral leadership, Paul, though hierarchically inferior to Peter, assumed it and felt it was even necessary to denounce him publicly. Imagine that transferred to modern times. Say, a recently called apostle in our church denouncing the president of the church in a general meeting like General Conference. It boggles the imagination. But the pattern is clear. We have moral leadership and inspiration flowing from below to above. I think it's very significant that a passage like this has found its way into the scriptures and survived there. Obviously, God wants us to ponder on the fact that our leaders, prophetic as they may be, sometimes have faults. If this had happened in General Conference, think what the following Ensign version would have been like after Correlation got hold of it. Paul and Peter would have been trading words of support, or perhaps Paul would have been edited out totally. And it is interesting that in the book of Acts, there's no hint of this conflict. Apparently, Luke edited it out. A second example comes from the Book of Mormon. We have Lehi and his clan in the desert on the way to the Red Sea. We have the good guys, the prophetic Lehi and Nephi, versus the bad guys, Laman and Lemuel. But, as often in the Book of Mormon, things are not quite that simple. Lehi, the chief prophet of the group, the man with the complete ecclesiastical and genealogical superiority, like Moses, like Peter, has a moral lapse. This is 1 Nephi chapter 16. We have a moment of crisis. Nephi has broken his bow. There was inadequate food for traveling, for the traveling exhausted company of desert travelers. Laman and Lemuel and the sons of Ishmael murmured, quote, exceedingly. And Lehi surprisingly joined them and, quote, began to murmur against the Lord his God, end quote. Then they all, quote, were exceedingly sorrowful, end quote, and murmured against the Lord together. What might have started out as a moment of discouragement for the elderly Lehi has ended up as a virtual group rebellion against God. Of course, it is Nephi who now assumes moral leadership. His reaction to Lehi's lapse is quite different from Paul's reaction to Peter's. But before he approaches Lehi, he denounces his brothers, who are hierarchically superior to him in family, if not ecclesiastical structure, for hardening their hearts to the extent of murmuring against God. There is an implicit reproach to Lehi here, for Lehi has been doing the same thing. Nephi then makes a new bow and arrow, and instead of denouncing his father, asks him for guidance. quote, "And I said unto my father, whither shall I go to obtain food?" Note that Nephi did not attack the hierarchical structure or try to place himself above Lehi, just as Paul wasn't trying to tear down Peter's authority in an absolute way. Instead, he tried to strengthen his father in his prophetic mission. Yet quiet and constructive as this response was, it was nevertheless a subtle but telling rebuke to an erring prophetic leader. Lehi inquires of the Lord and is strongly, now overtly, rebuked by God, quote, "insomuch that he was brought down into the depths of sorrow," end quote. Lehi consults the Liahona and receives further chastening so that he, quote, "did fear and tremble exceedingly," end quote. But it gives direction for Nephi's hunting. He finds and kills game, and the crisis is averted. Once again, we have a serious lapse in a chief prophet of a group and moral inspiration going from a hierarchically lesser figure to a higher. Nephi's sensitive response to his father is constructive, but it is no less a rebuke than Paul's to Peter. And the Lord explicitly reinforces it in Revelation to Lehi, which has been renewed as a result of Nephi's gentle critique. A third example is one of the delightful anecdotes from modern church history, the circumstances behind the bestowal of the Word of Wisdom Revelation. Joseph Smith, in February 1833, would hold the school of the prophets in a room above the kitchen of his house. According to Brigham Young, quote, "the first thing they did was to light their pipes and, while smoking, talk about the great things of the kingdom and spit all over the room." I love that phrase. "And as soon as the pipe was out of their mouths, a large chew of tobacco would then be taken. Often when the prophet entered the room to give the school instructions, he would find himself in a cloud of tobacco smoke. Emma complained at having to clean so filthy a floor, and according to Brigham Young, this, in part, quote, made the prophet think upon the matter, and he inquired of the Lord relating to the conduct of the elders in using tobacco, and the revelation known as Word of Wisdom was the result of his inquiry," end quote. David Whitmer adds a bit more, telling us that Emma actually suggested a revelation on the subject. Quote, "some of the men were excessive chewers of the filthy weed," this is David Whitmer, "and their disgusting slobbering and spitting caused Mrs. Smith to make the ironical remark that it would be a good thing if a revelation could be had declaring the use of tobacco a sin and commanding its suppression," end quote. Thus, Emma actually suggested a revelation. The idea of the revelation originally came from her. So here we have a person who is not even in the hierarchy of the church, technically, who had a spiritual insight that the prophet didn't have. Her flash of inspiration led her to prod the prophet into receiving a revelation, which he otherwise wouldn't have received, apparently. Her complaint, quote, made the prophet think upon the matter, end quote. So we have moral inspiration coming first to a non-hierarchical person, then moving upward to the head of the church. We also have the pattern of revelation coming through a husband-wife combination, which is a main theme of another paper I gave last year in Sunstone. Fourth, a curious incident from the life of Joseph F. Smith. I found this in the most conservative source possible, Smith's Gospel Doctrine, a Priesthood Manual. And I'm just going to summarize this to make more time for another story I want to add. What happened is Joseph F. Smith had been, at a very early age, had been a missionary in Hawaii, and there had been trouble with the notorious Walter Gibson as mission president, and so two apostles came to visit along with Joseph F. Smith to rearrange matters. And so Smith was the one who was familiar with the islands, he was familiar with the language, he was the interpreter. So they were getting ready to land. They had made the voyage, getting ready to land, and there was difficulty in landing. And what they had on the boat was a craft that was inadequate to get them to the island across a difficult passage of water. Joseph F. Smith knew, and so he told them, no way should we take this boat. And the senior apostles, there were two of them, it was Ezra Benson and Lorenzo Snow, got upset with him, and they said, well, we're going to take the boat. And one of the apostles said, young man, you would better obey counsel. Party got on the boat, but the strong-minded Joseph F. Smith, 25 years old, refused to leave the main ship. And the ship overturned, and everyone almost drowned, especially Lorenzo Snow. They fished him out of the water half dead. Interesting incident. Notice that here we have a young man who simply had more experience and knowledge in a limited area than men who, even though they were apostles, his ecclesiastical superiors, were newcomers to Hawaii and probably not too well acquainted with seafaring, at least in the Pacific. Also, it's significant that one of the apostles, perhaps Benson, who maybe should have bowed to the younger man's greater experience, demanded his obedience. But Smith, quote, reiterated his impression of danger, end quote, and refused to obey. And I found this in a priesthood manual. Okay. Thus, a church leader who seeks to wield his ecclesiastical authority in an area he has little or no expertise in is perhaps overstepping his bounds, despite his ecclesiastical authority. For instance, if a church leader makes sweeping judgmental and authoritarian statements on music, for example, he is perhaps overstepping his bounds if he has only a limited background in music. Notice that Smith's receptivity to an impression coincided with his knowledge and experience. Inspiration and perspiration go together, as they say about genius, perhaps. A final example is the conflict of Brigham Young and Orson Pratt over the Adam God doctrine, a topic so troubling to current church leadership that it has almost become a taboo topic like polygamy after the manifesto. Brigham Young, as church president, was a strong proponent of this doctrine, in which Adam is God the Father and Christ is Adam's literal son. And Orson Pratt was a strong opponent of it. In the fascinating, long-drawn-out conflict between these two strong-willed church leaders, chronicled by Bergera and Berger in Dialogue, Brigham Young never quite got Orson to knuckle under. And Orson, though he had moments of retraction, never stopped insisting that the doctrine did not square with the scriptures. Brigham Young always claimed that he had learned the Adam God doctrine from Joseph Smith, but Berger concludes, convincingly to me, that Joseph Smith didn't teach the doctrine. Young was either elaborating on Smith's teachings or misunderstood Smith's teachings. Though this, happily, maybe, leaves us without the necessity of believing in the Adam God doctrine, which I find confusing, it also leaves us with a rather unnerving view of a church president going pretty far astray doctrinally. But even though Young strongly believed in the doctrine, it is significant that he never advanced it as a revelation to be added to the Doctrine and Covenants, and that the body of the church, led by Pratt, vindicated by time, perhaps, never received it, to Young's frustration. Another example of the body of the church being more inspired than their leader in this instance. But I should add here, I personally accept Young as a prophet, an American Moses, as Arrington says, called by the Lord to fulfill a specific mission, which he did magnificently, though he was a very fallible human being, like us all. Perhaps doctrinal exploration was not Young's area of expertise. Like Snow and Benson in Hawaii's treacherous waters, he was out of his depth here, but in many other areas, Young's inspiration is very evident to me. These five examples will serve to delineate the pattern. Other examples could be multiplied. Another interesting example I'll mention briefly is Brigham and Orson also disagreed on whether God progresses in knowledge. We still haven't settled that one yet, satisfactorily. But depending on whether you think it's true or not, you can take the position that Orson was right again. And it kind of turns around in our day, because if you take the position that God does progress in knowledge, then Eugene England was right and Bruce R. McConkie was wrong. So you can, it proves my point either way. Perhaps also relevant is a common pattern in the Old Testament where a prophet, often from outside Jerusalem, prophesying against the corrupt priestly hierarchy that controls the temple, Christ even falls into this category to a certain extent. In addition, we should mention that the counselor system in our church government implicitly exhibits this pattern. If a prophet were infallible, omniscient, why would he need counselors? If he received a steady, direct stream of absolute revelation and were entirely self-sufficient and did not need help from below, he would not need counselors. Yet they are there, counselors for bishops, stake presidents, and the president of the church. I've always been impressed with what Joseph F. Smith said when he became president of the church. I propose that my counselors and fellow presidents in the first presidency shall share with me in the responsibility of every act that I shall perform in this capacity. I do not propose to take the reins in my own hands to do as I please, but I propose to do as my brethren and I agree upon. I have always held and do hold and trust I shall always hold, it's interesting emphasis, that it is wrong for one man to exercise all the authority and power of presidency in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I dare not assume such a responsibility, and I will not, so long as I have men like these, pointing to Presidents Winder and Lund, to stand by and counsel with me in the labors we have to perform. If at any time my brethren of the apostleship shall see me in a disposition to depart from this principle, or a forgetfulness on my part of this covenant that I make today before this body of priesthood, I ask them in the name of my Father that they will come to me as my brethren, as counselors in the priesthood, as watchmen on the towers of Zion, and remind me of this covenant and promise which I made to the body of the church and general conference assembled at this time. The Lord never did intend that one man should have all power. And for that reason, he has placed in his church presidents, apostles, high priests, 70s, elders, and the various officers of the lesser priesthood, all of which are essential in their order and place. That's the end of the quote. Here we have, connected with the concept of revelation going from lower to higher on occasion, the idea of revelation coming to a group. Thus, there is both an upward flow and a downward flow of inspiration. The counselor's insights and inspirations go up to the president, who in turn has a special link to God, and revelation comes down in response. Notice that this is interplay rather than an automatic reception of revelation and simple distribution downwards. Also, the president, in true humility, welcomes reproof from his hierarchical subordinates as watchman if he acts without taking counsel with those beneath him, the body of the church. Just to think about that a second, according to Joseph F. Smith, for us to reprove leaders who are too autocratic is not just an option, but our duty as watchmen on the towers of Zion. As we ponder this recommended ecclesiastical reproving, we remember that one other prophet authorized that he be reproved, or rather the Lord through him authorized that he be reproved. In one of the earliest revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants, the Lord instructed Oliver to reprove Joseph on occasion, admonish him, Joseph, in his faults, and also receive admonition of him. Thus we have an upward and downward interplay of reproval. But in the previous verse, Oliver is instructed to stand by my servant Joseph faithfully in whatsoever difficult circumstances he may be. Paradoxically, standing by a leader and reproving his faults are not opposed activities, if done in the right spirit. This is not to deny that many times the leader is right, the follower is wrong, which is perhaps most common, but the other possibility is there. God has put that pattern in the scriptures for us to reflect upon. I will now discuss some of the implications of this pattern for us as church members, for leaders, and for us as rank and file members of the church. First of all, it challenges us as leaders, if there are any leaders here, to take the ideas, insights, counsel, suggestions, and even rebukes of those hierarchically beneath us seriously, to accept inspiration wherever we may find it, and to look for it in other people, to realize that we are fallible morally and intellectually, and to have the courage to admit our mistakes and get back on track, as did Lehi, instead of doggedly pursuing a wrong course, instead of thinking that because we are leaders, everything we do is rubber-stamped as perfection. It can be very dangerous for us to equate our mistakes with the truth of the church. There is also the danger of not subjecting ourselves to the continual moral and intellectual self-examination that all human beings, fallible mortals, need, even church leaders. Perhaps especially church leaders, as their mission is so important. Lehi's community was much better off because Lehi did not lash out at the quiet rebuke given him by his son. And the rebuke, combined with Lehi's humility, opened the way for renewal of revelation in a community that was drifting away. The implications for us as rank and file in the church are also interesting and important. Let's return to the Antioch incident and apply it to a standard phrase from Mormonism, follow the brethren, perceived as an absolute principle. We have the situation, Peter eating with the Gentile Christians, the arrival of a group from James, and Peter, the church president, withdrawing from the gathering. Now others follow him, including Barnabas, Paul's missionary companion among the Gentiles. These people who withdrew with Peter were, literally, following the brethren, the president of the church. How does Paul view this obedience? Does he commend it, since the people were, after all, following the prophet of the church? No, he denounces it strongly. They are, quote, playing the hypocrite, end quote, along with Peter, and share his guilt. To Paul's shock, Barnabas, also an apostle and Paul's former mentor, is even led aside by their hypocrisy. Thus, if we follow church leaders who are not doing right, we are not absolved from wrongdoing. We share their guilt. And the conclusion is inescapable. Sometimes obedience to church leaders and obedience to God and moral justice are not the same thing. Joseph F. Smith was also told by an apostle, "You had better follow counsel." But the counsel of his religious superior was in conflict with his inspiration, and he followed his inspiration. This principle puts a real burden on us. It can be easy in one sense to live by a religious version of my country right or wrong, whatever my leaders say is right, and there is no reason to think about it, just do it unthinkingly. But it's clear that this isn't what the Lord wants. He requires us to subject our own and our leaders' actions and directives to moral and intellectual scrutiny. That is more difficult. Then if we find our leadership wanting morally, we even have a duty to deal with it somehow. Our first two scriptural examples give us two contrasting ways of dealing with the situation of an ecclesiastical leader having a lapse in moral vision. Paul chooses immediate, strong public denunciation. Nephi rebukes more subtly, encouraging his father to renew the prophetic gifts he should have been using. Are such rebukes disloyal? Haven't we raised our hands and vowed to sustain all our ecclesiastical leaders if we're members of the church? According to Joseph F. Smith and the pattern of the scriptures, no, we are not disloyal if we rebuke in a constructive way. If a leader is making mistakes, we're sustaining him more, helping him lead better if we point out the mistakes. We are standing by him as we admonish his faults, in the words of the Doctrine and Covenants. A good leader will be grateful for such help if it is given constructively. Thus, the subtly rebuking Nephi is supporting Lehi in his position as religious leader. Paradoxically, I think Paul was supporting Peter too, even as he rebuked him to his face. Certainly, Paul would have been aghast at the idea of staging a concerted rebellion against Peter's leadership. Peter had a brief, serious moral misjudgment. Paul felt he had to confront the senior apostle immediately, publicly, but he was certainly not trying to subvert the structure of the church. In Ephesians, he wrote that the church is built on the foundation of apostles and prophets, through whom we can attain the stature of Christ. Though the conflict at Antioch probably caused a major temporary breach between Gentile and Jewish factions of the early church, there are hints that Paul and Peter later continued working together somehow. In the church, we often strongly hold the idea of personal revelation, but we interpret it very hierarchically. You get personal revelation only for yourself. The prophet alone gets inspiration for the church. But the story of Emma and the Word of Wisdom shows that inspired insights for the benefit of the church can come to us non-hierarchical church members and can be, sometimes should be, relayed higher. We can respect the inspiration for the church that comes to us as ordinary low-profile saints with all our anonymity and faults. And if our leaders are sensitive and thoughtful, as Joseph Smith was, insights we receive can affect them and lead them to receive revelation. Finally, one last implication. In last summer's Sunstone, I gave a talk on women in priesthood, in which I argued that women have priesthood in our church and that it should be more recognized and integrated formally into the church structure. But as matters presently stand, women are not part of the church hierarchy. They are as excluded from the most important church positions, for instance, as I am, since I am an academic and a Sunstone contributor. However, I think this pattern shows us that women can receive revelation and inspiration for the benefit of the church, not just for themselves and their children, and that church leadership should be sensitive to it. Okay, how much time do I have left? I don't think I have enough for the Brigham Young story. We'll have to save that for later. I hope as leaders we can be sensitive to inspiration from those beneath us. And as rank and file, we can live close to the Spirit and convey inspiration to those above us every so often, and constructively be the loyal opposition on occasion, and that together we can all find the unity necessary in the gospel. Thank you.
Todd's paper, can you hear me? Is that, I'm kind of lower than the microphone. Todd's paper addresses the issue of alternate voices, although it was originally given at the California Sunstone Symposium, which took place before Dallin Oaks' talk at the April conference. So maybe we can say that Todd is a man ahead of his time. Todd has given us five intriguing examples from Scripture and church history which indicate that revelation might be given to someone other than the individual with greatest authority in the hierarchical ladder. Four of his examples involve inspiration given to ecclesiastical authorities or acknowledged spiritual leaders, although they were lesser authorities. One example involves inspiration channeled through a person not involved in the hierarchy at all, although a person with special access to the prophet, his wife. In three of Mr. Compton's five instances, in Todd's five instances, the reason given for challenging the higher authority was a moral reason. Paul rebukes Peter, among others, quote, when I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel. In one instance, the reason the junior authority felt inspired to contradict his superiors was a special knowledge or expertise in a limited area. In the final instance, the motivation for dissent lay in a long-standing intellectual agreement or a different theological perspective. I thought it might be interesting to explore the reasons why in each of Mr. Compton's, Todd's, five illustrations, we judge the individual of lesser authority or without authority to be the one truly inspired by the Holy Ghost. What convinces us that their insights were the revealed insights? In the case of Joseph F. Smith, the boating incident in Hawaii, the course of events seemed to uphold the junior member of the church delegation. This incident reminds us of the warning given by Levi Savage to members of the Willie Hancock Company that it was not safe to travel so late in the season, despite his chastisement by Franklin Richards for his lack of faith in God. In the case of Lehi's murmuring against God, it was the higher leader himself who admitted his mistake shortly after the tactful rebuke that was given him. In the Word of Wisdom scenario, again, the prophet himself sees the wisdom in his wife's remarks and takes up her case with the Lord. The confrontations of Paul and Peter and Orson Pratt and Brigham Young are less cut and dried. Both deal with a time of moral or intellectual uncertainty in a new church. It took several years in each case for the moral or intellectual opinion of the religious community to settle down firmly in concurrence with the voice that we now consider correct and inspired. In other such instances, the spiritual sense of the community has eventually favored the position of the presiding authority. For example, the strong moral stance of John W. Taylor and Matthias Cowley that polygamy was an eternal principle never to be abrogated was a compelling position for many but did not prevail in the church as a whole. Again, when Amasa Lyman, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, persisted in his deep theological conviction that men were perfectible on their own without the necessity of the atonement, Brigham Young dropped him from his position in the Quorum so that he wouldn't propound this view, and the church as a whole affirmed Brigham Young's theological rightness. There weren't a lot of spiritualists, eventually as the church continued, that would agree with Lyman's position. As we can see from these examples, we are able to see cases in which revelations come from unexpected sources because we do have some public sense of what kinds of things might demonstrate that a judgment was to be of the Holy Ghost. If it's inspired, things ought to turn out well. No boats capsizing or early snowstorms. If it's inspired, the proper authorities might eventually recognize it as such and adopt it. In the case of theology, if it's inspired, future generations will continue to find it scriptural and sound. However, we don't often expect revelations to come from the bottom up because without convincing proof to the contrary, we consider the source of revelation to be the indication of its authenticity. Unless there's good reason to believe otherwise, if it comes from the right source, it's revelation. If you want to prove otherwise, you've got to come up with a good example, as Mr. Compton does. Now, I should point out that I'm talking about our public perception of what is inspired by the Holy Ghost. I think our private perceptions are more informed with the kinds of things that we read about in the ninth section of the Doctrine and Covenants or in the chapters in the Book of Messiah that talk about the response of the people to King Benjamin's address. They say, this is how we feel, and this is why we feel inspired by the Holy Ghost, and they give some very definite kinds of feelings they have. What I'm talking about here is our general public judgment that something is of the Holy Ghost, and that comes from more external kinds of evidence. There are two things that I'd like to see Mr. Compton do in his paper. I would like to see more examples of non-hierarchical revelation other than those dealing with the inspirations of junior authorities in the hierarchy. What about the formation of the auxiliaries of the church, for example, most of which were started by someone not in a position of authority at all, who saw a need and then their program was adopted by the church? What about the influence of a member who might have the courage to write a general authority, giving his or her own perspective and receive a favorable response? To bring up a current issue, Ed Firmage is attempting to do for women's issues what his grandfather, Hubie Brown, did for the issue of blacks in the priesthood. But Hubie Brown was a member of the ecclesiastical hierarchy and expressed his feelings privately, and Ed Firmage is outside of the hierarchy and he's expressing he's using the route of public expression. Are there any examples of someone doing that and having an impact? I'd like to know. What about the moral attitudes of church members as a whole? Are there times when the general church membership has felt certain moral concerns on a certain issue and encouraged the prophet to consider it more seriously? Some feel that the revelation of the extension of the priesthood to all male members of the church came not only because the leaders had come to a point where they were pleading for light on the subject, but because members had come to a point that they were willing to receive the response. As a personal example, a dear older relative who I consider to be a very, very good person, who said to me once before the revelation, it will be a sad day when blacks are admitted to the temple. And I was immediately shocked by this relative's comment, not because I was a superior person morally, I think the individual was really a much better person than I am, but because I lived in a generation where we were accustomed to hearing the voices of blacks and where that kind of attitude was just not acceptable. And I think we have changes like that in general church attitude. And, you know, are there examples of that making an impact? Finally, I would like to see Mr. Compton explore more analytically the hierarchical ladder he presumes. He does begin such an analysis by discussing one way to view the counselor system. And he uses a lengthy quote from Joseph S. Smith. And when he was reading that, I was wondering if perhaps Joseph F. Smith's willingness to listen to lower members of the hierarchy were a result of his own experience in the boating incident when he himself had not been listened to, and perhaps that had an impact on the way he viewed the way that the hierarchy should operate. We all have slightly different views of what constitutes the ladder and how it operates. What one person considers a non-hierarchical revelation might seem to another to be in perfect agreement with the true operation of hierarchy. To illustrate, I'd like to use an example of some advice that Carl Broderick was given by Boyd K. Packer when Carl Broderick was made a stake president. Okay, here's Packer to Broderick. Now president, referring to the new stake president, I don't want you treating your wife like you do the stake. Broderick, I wasn't planning on treating either the stake or my wife badly. Packer, I know, but you need to treat them well differently. In the stake, when a decision is to be made, you will seek the opinion of your counselors and other concerned individuals. Then you will prayerfully reach a decision on the matter, and they will all rally round and support you because you are the president and you have the mantle of authority. In your family, when there is a decision to be made that affects everyone, you and your wife together will seek whatever counsel you might need, and together you will prayerfully come to a unified decision. If you ever pull priesthood rank on her, you will have failed in your leadership. And Crawford Broderick relates that he really liked the role appropriate that Elder Packer felt was appropriate to the role of wife for. The way that he related to his counselors. He liked that as a model for the role of counselor. And that's the one he wanted, the more participatory model. And revelation given to a counselor on this model would not be construed as revelation given in violation of a hierarchical procedure, but as revelation given in accordance with a hierarchical pattern that recognized the wisdom of collaborative effort in seeking the will of the Lord. A further issue Todd raised that I just thought about as he was that I didn't really write remarks before when he was making his presentation was, you know, the really big issue that we all deal with is what is your responsibility if you believe that your hierarchical leader is telling you to do something that you believe is morally wrong? In that kind of hierarchical analysis, we have several kinds of approaches. For example, there's the approach which Boyd K. Packer has often set forth, that you do what the leader has asked you to do, and that leader will be responsible forever for whatever action is taken. If it's the wrong action, it's not your fault. God won't hold you responsible. It's the responsibility of the leader. Hubie Brown expressed it at BYU Devotional another opinion. I wish I'd brought the quote, very strongly expressing that God holds you morally responsible for your own acts, and that ultimately you have the responsibility. So from general authorities, we have two kinds of approaches, and perhaps the way the hierarchy works even among them is not firmly pinned down. I think that the best treatment of this is Gene England's essay in Dialogues with Myself on Obedience and Integrity. And he also uses some examples, as Todd does, and tries to analyze them and see what impact they could make in our own lives. But I think we all realize situations, in our own experience in the church, where a church leader will have a different opinion, or different church leaders will have different opinions of how the hierarchy operates. And that influences the extent to which they're willing to allow impact, or the extent to which they're willing to, perhaps a bishop, go against something that a stake president has recommended because he has his own opinions about the matter. He has a different opinion of what's right. Different bishops will act differently in those situations. Because we really don't have a real defined sense of how this hierarchy operates, we all have our own viewpoints that we're coming from in our own positions. So I would have liked to have Mr. Compton talk a little bit more to that issue. How do we define that kind of thing as a people? I enjoyed his comments.
We'd like to now open it up to questions from the audience. I'll repeat your question, and please address it to either Catherine or Todd.
I'd like to ask Todd two things. Number one, how ancient was the priesthood manual that he got his story from? Secondly, will you please tell us the Brigham Young story?
Well, that manual was used back when they had real books as priesthood manuals, like once. Yeah, sorry, okay. That manual was used before, when they had real books for priesthood manuals instead of what we have now. In other words, one year they had a book by Hugh Nibley as the priesthood manual, It's incredible. And by the way, it's interesting. There's a story about that. I heard Nibley talking about it once, and he says that there was great opposition to using that among the general authorities, but here's a time when the president was right. David O. McKay, all along the line, he came down on the side of using the Nibley book as the manual. So it was a while back. The Brigham Young story, gosh, that'll take some time to tell that. But I guess I can summarize it somewhat, but I'm not doing it justice. This is a really interesting story that some real historian should work on. I'm not a Mormon historian, and they will work on it. So this is just like a preliminary outline. Basically what happened is the first two prophets of our church evidently wanted their sons to succeed them as presidents of the church. And it's very interesting that it didn't happen in either case. The evidence for Brigham Young, we know the Joseph Smith story pretty well. The evidence for Brigham Young is that he ordained three of his sons apostles when they were extremely young. In fact, he ordained John Willard Young, an apostle, when he was 10 years old. And you can talk about motives in that case, but the practical, practical implication of that is that, given the way succession was running, he would become prophet. And it's a very interesting story why he didn't become prophet, and it involved a number of changes in policy on how succession worked in the early church, which would take a little bit of time to explain. At first, there was succession by how old you were. then there was more of an emphasis on inclusion in the quorum and ordination. Joseph Smith never ordained anyone to be an apostle if they weren't going to come into the quorum, with one exception we won't get into. And so there's an ambiguity there. Do you get succession in the quorum, and by implication succession to become the prophet, when you are ordained an apostle or when you become a member of the Quorum of the Twelve? They were both the same for a while. Brigham Young threw a monkey wrench into that whole problem when he started ordaining people apostles and not putting them in the Quorum of the Twelve. So then we have this ambiguity. Do they get succession to the presidency by when they were ordained apostles or when they were put into the quorum? So basically what happened is that the policy came about that they were given seniority by when they were ordained. And this is a Brigham Young policy. How it happened is very interesting. I don't know if I have time to get into it. I'll read a couple quotes. In April 17th, 1864, okay, he's ordained three of his sons apostles secretly. He didn't tell the quorum about this. In April 17th, 1864, he told selected members of the quorum, John Taylor and George A. Smith. He told them about it, and he asked them for their vote of confidence, and they gave it. Quote from the Journal of Wilford Woodruff. President Young said, "I am going to tell you something that I have never before mentioned to any other person. I have ordained my sons, Joseph A., Brigham Jr., and John Willard, apostles and my counselors." I think this was the idea, that if they're going to be counselors, they have to be apostles too. "Have you any objections?" John Taylor and George A. Smith said they had not, that it was his own affair and they considered it under his own direction. He further stated, "In ordaining my sons, I have done no more than I am perfectly willing that you should do with yours, and I am now determined to put my sons into active service in the spiritual affairs of the kingdom and keep them there just as long as possible. You have the same privilege." Okay, he hasn't put them in the quorum yet. On October 6, 1867, we have a vacancy in the quorum, which is Amasa Lyman, which was referred to by my respondent. And so now we have here's another quote from Journal of Brigham Young, Jr. Brother George, Brigham Young went to George A. Smith again and said he was planning on putting his son, Brigham Young, Jr., into the quorum. Brother George A. Smith suggested that it might raise a question and comment if Brigham Young, Jr. was put in place of Brother Lyman apostatized. And if Joseph F. Smith was now put into the quorum, it would make no difference, as Brigham Young, Jr. was ordained an apostle before Joseph F. Smith and would take his place in the quorum according to that ordination. Okay, in other words, we have the principle that you get seniority by when you were ordained, clearly reflected in this quote. So Brigham Young, very interestingly, bowed to the judgment of George A. Smith. Here's my non-hierarchical revelation angle here. He bowed to the judgment of George A. Smith, which is an interesting thing for someone as strong-willed as Brigham Young to do. And I think it showed that he had some wisdom and humility. Okay, so October 12, 1867, Joseph F. Smith was set apart to the Quorum of the Twelve. And in 1868, Brigham Young, Jr. filled the next vacancy in the quorum. So what did that do? Who became president of the church? Joseph F. Smith. And it's very interesting, in their first conference, Joseph F. Smith was sustained ahead of Brigham Young, Jr., but in the next conference, it was turned around. Brigham Young, Jr. was sustained ahead of Joseph F. Smith. So apparently Brigham Young had corrected it, and it looked like Brigham Young had seniority. Brigham Young, Jr. had seniority. Okay, much later, Brigham Young is sustained that way throughout the rest of the century, basically. John Willard, who was ordained when he was 10 years old, Brigham Young made him his first counselor in the first presidency at one time, shortly before he died. But he was never put into another vacancy in the quorum. Okay. The end of the story coming up. Brigham Young died August 29, 1877. The First Presidency was dissolved. John Willard and Daniel Wells, first and second counselors, were made counselors to the 12th. Interesting position. And then we have a succession of different presidents. Taylor, Woodruff, Snow, Lorenzo Snow became presidents of the church. On October 6th, okay. On October 6, 1891, John Willard was released as counselor to the 12. So this person who, as a young boy, had been ordained an apostle was now totally out of the practical hierarchy of the church. But according to the policy that was still in effect, he was, you know, in line to be president pretty clearly. But perhaps business and family failures caused the 12 to want to distance him from the church hierarchy. And if you get the book on the letters of Brigham Young to his sons and read the little biography of John Willard, it's a heartbreaking biography. He lived a very tragic life. Okay, March, final chapter of the story, March 31st, 1900, Snow, Lorenzo Snow, Cannon, and Joseph F. Smith, who are now the First Presidency, had a private discussion. In it, they agreed that seniority in the quorum should come by entrance into the quorum. So they're getting rid of this different policy. Snow told Joseph Smith that Brigham Young ranked beneath him in seniority, which flatly denied the General Conference sustainings from 1869 on, and just simply reversed Brigham Young, what Brigham Young had wanted. On April 5th, 1900, at a meeting of the First Presidency and Council of the Twelve in the Salt Lake Temple, quote, "It was unanimously decided that the acceptance of a member into the Council or Quorum of the Twelve fixed his rank or position in the apostleship," which is policy we have now, "that the apostles took precedence from the date they entered the quorum, that ordination to the apostleship under the hands of any apostle, other than to fill a vacancy in the quorum, and authorized by the general authorities of the church, did not count in precedence." Thus, Brigham Young Jr. and Joseph F. Smith changed their position of seniority, took the place they had originally, the very first general conference, and now John Willard has no seniority at all. Okay, so Snow's ruling prevented Brigham Young's original wishes from being fulfilled, evidently. If Snow had not made the ruling, Brigham Young, and soon after, John Willard would have been president of the church, of our church. Again, the point I want to emphasize is that at this one specific place, the Lord worked through George A. Smith, Brigham Young's hierarchical inferiors, to prevent Brigham Young's sons from succeeding him, which evidently was not in the economy of God. So that's a very interesting story.
Time's up.
So. I'm sorry, but our time's up, and we'd like to thank the participants, and the session is now at a close.